of
Two years ago, life changed. 2 years ago, 6 million people were still alive. 2 years ago, 446 million cases of COVID didn't exist. 2 years ago, there was graduations. There was parties, there was vacations. There was grandparents going to their grandchildren, people having a good time, proms, all types of things, but things changed. 2 years ago was the pandemic. And we're here today to discuss particularly how that pandemic has affected college students and people working in colleges. And we have an excellent panel today, which I would like to introduce for you. Why don't you introduce yourself? You know yourself better than me. So go right ahead.
I'm Dr. Henry Humphreys. I'm the Vice Chancellor and Dean of Students for the East Falls campus of Jefferson.
Hi, I'm Dr. Virginia O'Hare, and I'm a clinical psychologist and the director of the Jefferson Center City Clinic for Behavioral Medicine.
Hi, I'm Julia Smith. I am a second year graduate student in the Community and Trauma Program.
Hi, my name is Rafaela Gualtieri, and I am a senior student in the CTC program.
And one of my students as well, so I take credit for her here today. My name is Evan Lane. I'm the faculty director of the Arlen Specter Center. This is one of the events we put on every year. It's the Lawrence Katz Memorial Lecture. Please, everyone, if you can, please go on mute and take yourself off video. What I'd like to begin at this point is to personalize it in a way, because although we are holding ourselves out as being some sort of experts here today, we're all part of what happened. And I like to start off with my emotion that I had and my experience, and then I'll leave it to the panel to each tell us what you went through. I remember 2 years ago, I was over at my daughter's house, and we had heard all this was happening. It was in the weeds. But as usual, denial, it's going to go away, it's going to be okay. It's like those snowstorms they tell us are always coming and it don't come, you know, that kind of thing. It's not going to happen, but it happened. And the first thing my wife and I said is, we got to get food. And we ran over to, you know, to the Aldi's, which is not too far away, and it was closed. And I remember that panic at that moment. That, wait a minute, I may not have food for my family. This is the real deal. And I, sitting here now, I could feel that moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to start with Henry, with you.
I think when you talk that story, I think about the awards banquet for the swim team for my daughters. One was a senior, one was a freshman. And at that awards banquet, it was a Sunday before everything shut down. I was getting texts from the university from various people talking about things are coming, we need to be prepared, and being like, okay, but everything's gonna be okay. And then that Friday, my daughter's school shut down and my oldest daughter was a senior, sat there bawling, saying, everything I've worked for is gone. There's no senior prom, there's no graduation. I can't visit colleges. And I sat there trying to tell her, it's okay, it's only gonna last for a couple of weeks, honey. And then everything's gonna be okay. And with the coming days, it quickly became clear that this wasn't going to be a quick fix. And we were in for a long haul. And that's the first thing I think of when I think to this anniversary coming up of 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So my mind goes in two directions. First of all, I also have a grocery store kind of thing that punches me in the gut. So my husband is an immuno-oncologist and had given, he, you know, we've had a lot of sort of dry runs of COVID with like H1N1, et cetera. There's always like the big snowstorm that's coming that we need to prep for. So this was kind of yet another of these. Although I went to the grocery store, got in and filling my carts with my two children who at the time were eight and five and filling the carts up. And realizing like we're choosing stuff like rice and like yeast and things to bake food with. And the kids are like, oh, let's get ice cream. I'm like, okay, but we're, so anyway, we end up with two carts filled right to the top of like survival gear, everything that, you know, fun things, but also kind of things for living. And behind me, people are like, is this because of that, that, you know, coronavirus? And I'm not trying to, you know, start a panic. I was like, oh, maybe. So I'm kind of trying to keep it light for the kids. They're like, why are we buying so much stuff? I'm like, oh, who knows? And so anyway, we wipe out one place. And then I'm thinking, well, stuff's still open. So then we go to Whole Foods, right, to get more. And you know, hundreds of dollars that are being spent on this, where I'm thinking, like, thank goodness for this, like, privilege of affluence that we're able to drop money on this. And then my mind also goes to at work in our clinic, wrenching right in front of one of those Jefferson cameras, trying to wrench the hand sanitizer machine off the wall. And my secretary saying, like, you're on camera. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. And I'm pulling it off and I give it to her. And I was like, take this for you and your family, because we couldn't buy any at this point. And she's like, and I said, we're going to be shut till September. And she's like, September? And I was like, yes. So she's got this giant hand sanitizer thing, right? Totally my fault, not hers. And I've got these littles of hand sanitizer. I'm giving one to somebody else and thinking, here, we're going to shut down till September, which seemed insurmountable. But yet, how did we know it was going to be 2 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't even really pinpoint one emotion. There was the grocery store and like the panic of there being no food in the shelves because I was late to the game. And then there was the, okay, well, we're going to be out for 2 weeks at work. And I was like, okay, 2 weeks, this is fine. And then it was just dread from there on. Like, it was just like, oh my gosh, how am I going to work in this one bedroom apartment with my significant other? And like, how am I going to start school? Like, am I going to be virtual? The lack of social relationships. My family's from Ohio, so I was worried about my family in Ohio and are they okay? So it was more just like, what is happening? Like, there, I don't have one specific moment that I can like pinpoint of, oh my God, this is real. It was more so just like everything constantly coming and not being able to handle it.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that feeling of not having one specific emotion. I know one event sticks out for me. A coworker was just scrolling and following it in Italy, and she was freaking out. She was like, oh my God, like everything's going to like shut down here and we're going to be as bad as Italy. And I was like, nah, we'll be fine. Like everything's okay. Nothing to worry about. It's not going to happen here. And then next thing you know, everything got shut down and it felt surreal. Like it wasn't really happening. And it took a while for my emotions to catch up until I finally was like, wow, this is it.
I just want to add one thing. I know I gave one, but something came to me when I was listening to you. Mm-hmm. When Tom Hanks got it.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, yes. Oh my God, Tom yeah. Hanks has it. Like it really hit home.
In Australia, no less.
In Australia, of all places. So what we want to do, and for the crowd who's listening, we're going to take questions. If you send to spectrecenter at jefferson.edu, we have somebody actually looking at your questions and we'll address them. What I want to do is talk about the symptoms, things we've experienced, things that you have seen students complain of, your patients complain mm-hmm. of, experienced. And then once we hash those out, explore options on how we can hopefully deal with all that stuff that we've been through. So I think the best thing to deal with, I'd like to go to Rafaela because we asked a number of people, undergrads and faculty and graduate students and staff, to give us anonymously their experiences. So if you can give us one and we'll, I'd like the panel then to consider it. Go ahead.
Sure. So here's the first story. Going from extreme extroversion used to mask my issues to extreme introversion was shocking and incredibly difficult. I did not speak to a single person outside of my house for months and was forced to go into weekly therapy. I lived my pre-COVID life just getting by, and when I was forced to face the issues in my life and was isolated, I could not handle it. I had to rebuild myself from the ground up and rebuild my trust and bond with my family.
Why don't we go to Henry first?
Wow. I heard that in many different versions from students. I think the pandemic, the shutting down of the world, exposed all these vulnerabilities that students had that none of us were aware of. They didn't have computers. They were using university stuff. They didn't actually have a home that they lived at. Mm-hmm. They were here, and suddenly they're living in a car. They didn't have internet. They didn't have regular access to food. They had mental health issues, but no one knew because they were hiding mm-hmm. them. And suddenly, all of these things that they had hidden from each other and themselves in some regards, suddenly were at our doorstep and we're looking for help. How do you help us resolve this? Because we need something now. So I think that was, I always talk about the fragile resiliency. They were resilient. We pushed them and it fell apart. And I think that they've come back to that resiliency, but it's still fragile. But that was definitely one of the first things I noticed was everything came apart, as you're saying.
And the interesting thing is for the three of you that treat people is usually you're treating people, but you're not experiencing what they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. You know, you may have your own things going on, but you're not experiencing, but you have to deal with people with some really serious issues while you mm-hmm. are having those issues as well. And as a therapist, how did that impact on it?
Yeah, I mean, the type of therapy that I typically do, dialectical behavior therapy or DBT, part of the sort of foundation of that therapy is that the therapist is at times radically genuine. So like transparent, kind of drops the lab coat, drops the doctor-patient relationship and is much more sort of egalitarian. Mm-hmm. So that I felt like was a huge boost in that I didn't have to be kind of more of a blank slate. I was able to say, you know, wow, like this is a lot, you know, what's your experience like, and hear from the patient. And they could see that, you know, they could see on my face, they could hear in my voice that this is something that I was going through also. And for some things, I think, you know, this is what I went into the field for, right? To really be like in the trenches with people when things are rough. And at the same time, I understand that there are many people for whom this is not what they went into the field for. You know, I had trainees at the time who were saying like, I can't be someone's therapist and be processing my own reactions to the pandemic. Whereas I don't know, I feel like for me, the ability to be genuine within the therapy that I was doing led to like a shared experience with the patients.
This thing that Rafaela read for us mm-hmm. deals a lot with isolation, which I think is probably one of the most important symptoms. Or how did that affect people and how do we deal with that? And even in your own personal experience, I can tell you that sitting in your room on Zoom all day talking mm-hmm. to students is a weird experience. Mm-hmm. Not having your, and listen, I'm privileged. I have my office, I have everything, and I have all that. And I'm sitting in my gym shorts, you know, obviously with a nice shirt on. But it was strange that we have friends that we see all the time and we stop seeing them, just stop. They weren't in our bubble, you know? Mm-hmm. And we visited them one time and we sat like 20 feet apart from each other with masks on. And that was bizarre. It just was bizarre. And I was like, how have you seen students deal with that?
I was actually talking to Virginia about this whenever we started. And I'm noticing even in myself, like just hypervigilance, someone's coughing. You're like, oh my gosh, is that COVID? Like, how do I talk to people? Like, I forgot how to communicate. And we're seeing that in students, in clients, and even just like you said, like our everyday relationships, things are being impacted that you attribute to COVID, but you're not actually realizing like, oh my gosh, this is because of COVID. This has impacted my life so significantly, because now we're going back to normal life. And people are thinking, oh, I just have to go back to how I was. Like, I have to forget that. Like, I just have to get over it. And I don't think people are realizing they don't have to get over it. They just have to adjust. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like one of the biggest things.
That's a very good point. So if we say, okay, that happened and it's mm-hmm. over, is that a healthy way to deal with it?
Mm. I also don't know. Do we want to go back, right? And I think about the analogy of like, you can never stuff that sleeping bag back into like the stupid little like nylon bag that it comes with, you know? And I feel like there are probably things that we don't want to put back in the bag. You know, I think that the connections, the ability to connect over Zoom, you know, which as someone who works with people with who are immunocompromised, I can bring groups together who typically wouldn't be able to interact, like people with cystic fibrosis who can't be next to each other because of, you know, infection risk. So I think that those are innovations that we don't necessarily want to let go of. And at the same time, I think it's unrealistic to think that we can kind of erase 2 years worth of how we're going to interact with other humans.
I also think that would cheapen people's experience. If you were told, forget about it, it sure didn't happen now.
Yep.
No, it was real. It's part of who you were. It's never going to, that's not going to change. I personally, the one bright spot I'm hoping to take out of all this is everyone was very reliant upon technology and on their phones all the time, but suddenly they were told, that's the only way you can communicate with anybody else. And I really think that people might start to revert back to wanting more of that in-person, the seeing people without a mask, talking to them instead of, well, yeah, my roommate's one room over, but I'm just going to text them instead of talking to them face to face. So I think the two things is not to forget and not to give it up, but also to remember some of the lessons learned so that you get those reconnections with people.
Mm-hmm. But going back a little, what was the cost of people who, not all of us have significant others. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of us had to live in small apartments, we have alone. Mm-hmm. And the only contact would be by Zoom, which is hardly good enough. What have you seen as the cost of that?
I see that a lot among my own student trainees. So like master's level clinicians working toward their PhD in clinical psychology, whereas, you know, I'm in the suburbs with my kids and my husband and my dogs and my stockpile of food. And they're in these tiny apartments in the city, which I can relate to because that's how I used to live when I was a student, right? Who cares about size of apartment? You can't afford a bigger apartment and you want to be right in the heart of it all, right? And then learning that we can't bring around other people, can't really leave my apartment. And they're supposed to be somebody's therapist in their one bedroom apartment, which is also this kind of pressure to like have the, at least the few feet behind you look tidy and neat. So I just saw a lot of isolation, depression, anxiety among the students who I was working with.
Be a good time to look at the first slide we have because it shows you right here, this was a study that was conducted across a number of universities. And it talks about what they experience, these different students. A lot of it has to deal with being in classroom and the effect of not being around other students and not feeling motivated. I can tell you, as teaching Zoom for as long, I can't believe how long it was. It sort of blends in this gray matter. But keeping people engaged, usually in their bedrooms, and I know you would say people, the worst place in the world to be is your bedroom because that's your bed and you're going to be asleep in a couple of minutes, whatever it may be, or it's just, it's supposed to be your happy place where you relax, where you're going to watch TV before you go to bed at night, whatever it may be. And now you're, this is work. So I saw a lot of that. How did you see with students, what were they complaining about? Or what were they discussing with you?
I think the biggest thing they were complaining about was they were trying to learn why their brothers and sisters were trying to learn why their parents were trying to do their jobs and there wasn't a lot of place to go. Or quite frankly, you talk about bandwidth, it truly was the bandwidth in which they, for the technology, that it was unreliable. So it was the frustration of trying to learn why everybody else is trying to do the same thing around you in a very confined space. And you couldn't even get away from them, unless you were so fortunate to live in an area where you had a big backyard or something. But yeah, you're in the city. I mean, that's why dogs were getting walked, you know, 20 times a day, just so someone could get out around.
They've never been happier.
That's right.
When I went to school, and we're all a little more recent than me and Henry, but the social life was just as important. We come from a long line in my family of meeting our significant others at college and getting married. And that was put off. I had one student say, and it freaked me out. He says, we're juniors. Do you realize this is the first time we've been on campus when the weather is good? And I go, what?
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, it's our first time. Missing the parties, missing meeting people, missing just getting together. That is also a very large thing. And how do we get that back if we can?
I'm going to defer.
Let's go to Rafael because you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know for me, my first year at Jefferson was my first time on campus. because when I started, it was all online.
Yeah.
So when I came here, I had to navigate campus for the first time. And then also figure out like how to interact and engage with other students. And I think a lot of people that commute or are here for the first time can relate to that, because now they were home and now they're going into an environment that they haven't been in a while, or it's their first time, which can be really overwhelming, especially if you are commuting in and if you don't really know anyone. Like to begin with.
The whole thing about going back home. I remember when I go back in the summers, because I went away and come back in the summer, and that was a whole different deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was, let's say, and I have a good family and so forth, but that was fraught with, where are you going tonight? What are you doing? I wasn't used to telling anyone anymore where I'm going, who I'm going, where, you know, what time I'm coming back, anything. And it's like, I'm going out. Yeah, none of your business.
Yeah.
And imagine, I could just imagine the students who had been used to the freedom going back into the household to, in some cases, unfortunately, to parents who are not as tolerant of the lifestyle
that they
mm-hmm. got used to in many different ways and the freedoms that they had in school.
Yes. I don't, I'm very careful what I say because I don't want to identify any student, but yes, there were a lot of students who their lifestyle was not known to their parents, or was known but was never confronted. So they knew about it, but they never saw it. And suddenly the students were feeling unwelcome in their own households and feeling very alien and looking to us, quite frankly, can you help? Can we come back and live there because we can't live here? And it was a very stressful time for students and looking for help. And we were at a disadvantage. We didn't have a whole lot of resources because nobody knew what you could or could not do initially to help people. It was a very stressful time, I think, across the spectrum, but definitely confronted with, I was leading a life my family didn't even know I was leading, or seeing somebody they didn't know I was seeing, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. We talked about isolation. I'd also like to talk about anger. Personally, I have a lot of anger that I have to deal with. My wife now will not go shopping with me. She's listening right now, okay? She says, when you go shopping, you spot the anti-maskers, you spot them and you get angry, you're gonna make a comment, I know it. And I've been seriously close to three physical confrontations with people because of the anger that I have. I could imagine the anger would also spill out, never mind that, but to the lost opportunities,
mm-hmm.
the lost parties, the lost proms, the lost graduations, the lost celebrations, the lost weddings. We can go mm-hmm. on and on. And I was wondering if you have also dealt with that with people coming in to talk to you. How do you deal with the anger?
Well, I think there's anger on both ends. There's anger with people being upset that they have lost out on experiences like weddings and graduations, things like that. But then it's like the opposite of you, the anger that the pandemic was being made such a big deal.
Uh-huh.
So there were really two ends of the spectrum that, I mean, we, as a therapist, you can't really let your beliefs come out.
Right.
Like, if you believe in the mask but your client doesn't, you can't say no, you're wrong. So it still is a very fine line, like vaccine mandates and things like that. And we're seeing that in students as well. Like, I mean, Rafaela and I are students, but Henry, you're seeing people that don't believe in the vaccine or are unable to get the vaccine. So dealing with the anger is just letting people feel the anger and letting them know that that's valid. You're allowed to be angry and the anger is really not going to go anywhere. You can't tell somebody like, no, you're not allowed to be angry anymore. Like, it's really just letting them feel it at that point.
And also letting them know you don't have to agree with the other person. That's what they believe. You have to respect their right to what they believe, but let them know this is what I believe. And let them know that it does frustrate you. But I don't think we have to say, well, because I disagree with them, I won't talk with them, I won't deal with them, I won't whatever. Mm-hmm. It's, I have to respect the person, but you know what? You don't want to wear a mask and I do. So I tell you what, I'm going to do it. You do what you need to do, but mm-hmm. please respect what I'm going to do at the same time. And I think that's part of that anger part. You have to let them have mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, I know for myself, I was getting really frustrated, like what you were talking about, like it's always being talked about. And for me, eventually I got to the point like, okay, I need some space and time to just not hear about any of this and to just get away from it, go outside for a walk mm-hmm. or do something on my own where it's just quiet. Because I think for me, it was really helpful to have space from all of that.
I want to go back to the testimony, graduate mm-hmm. students.
Okay. Right ahead. So the sense of anxiety I have always felt within myself has become a full-fledged disorder. I cannot help but feel behind academically, socially, and professionally because of all of the opportunities I must hope I can one day reschedule. Morally, I feel every social issue regarding the pandemic so deeply, and it has become impossible to silence the noise. I worry about bringing new lives into this world that has proved to be so hateful and broken. I feel concerned that I will not be prepared for social aspects of my future career due to the comfort I have found in isolation.
Wow. Mm-hmm. While we take that in, I just want to thank the students in the Bridge program for helping me get these statements. They're an organization on campus. Shout out to Bridge. Anyway, taking that in, first of all, wow. Is this something that you have seen working with trauma, which is your master's that you're working on?
Yeah, I think so. With the undergrad, they're saying that they hate the isolation, but whenever you become so immersed in the safety of like your comfort, you don't want to leave that. And one of my clients right now is actually a nurse. So she has, she's dealt with, a different aspects of trauma, but specifically COVID as being a nurse. One of the things that she said to me was, I can't go out in public without seeing body bags.
Wow.
And that was, I think that was kind of one of the moments where I was like, oh my gosh, like, I don't have that realization in my life. I don't see body bags when I go out. And she's no longer a nurse. She's stopped her career. She stopped her life because of the impact that COVID has had on her. And that's really like one of the most awakening things that I've seen in my journey so far.
It reminds me when we came back.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working here 10, 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been taking the same exit for mm-hmm. 10, 12 years, okay? Off of 76. And I missed the exit the first time because it was I was heading into something weird, something different,
mm-hmm.
out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I was in comfort in my shorts at home, in my office. And suddenly I was going back and I walked into this room we're here now, and on the desk across from us was a newspaper that someone delivered March of 2020, and it freaked me out
mm-hmm.
because it was like I was entered into a dystopian
thing.
You felt the same way.
I'm thinking about the first time I actually had to come to campus after everything shut down because we had students here, and I'm on Schuylkill doing 85 miles an hour, and I'm the only car there. And at first I'm like, this is great. And then I felt like I've been one of those movies where you're the only person left.
Yeah.
And it was very disconcerting, fun at points, but really disconcerting also.
So now's a good time to talk about what we can do to help each other cope with what we've been through and deal with best we can. So let's begin with that.
Mm-hmm.
Who would like to start?
Sure. I mean, one thing that comes up for me in my own life and for the patients that I work with and the students who I supervise is this kind of this idea of kind of getting to know what do you want to stand for, what do you want to be about, kind of like your values. And some of that could have changed or likely has changed throughout the course of COVID. So for example, for me personally, I never knew that it was one of my major passions to help hospital systems, like, you know, groups of nurses or physical therapists or, you know, ER physicians, to help them with coping skills for dealing with not just the pandemic, but like job turnover and kind of lack, low morale on teams. So that's really become my jam. I love that. And I didn't, you know, that wasn't on my radar before the pandemic. And then I see with my students, many of whom have never seen a patient in person, kind of speaking to the graduate experience and thinking about, you know, maybe their approach to what they want to do within mental health or what they want to do in life has changed. And with a lot of my patients too, thinking about, is the career, the job, or the sort of, you know, a lot of my patients are living in or working jobs that are, you know, kind of not really what they want to be about, like maybe working in the service industry and, you know, it's kind of a means to an end to paying the bills. And many of my patients have had kind of an awakening during COVID of like, you know, I really want to do something different. I want to be a musician, or I want to stay in this job to pay the bills, but also on the side to do this thing that I'm truly passionate about. So I think COVID has given us kind of an injection of like, what do you want to be about? And I think that could be a real positive.
How about you, Henry?
I have a lot of thoughts about how people should take care of themselves. One of the things I keep coming back to is I was near ground zero, 9/11. And the neighborhood I came from in New York, a lot of people were lost also. And as we moved beyond that, it was, we didn't want to live in that moment, but we didn't want to forget that moment. We didn't want to forget what happened. We did make life changes because of that, what was more important to us. But we never lost the story. As a matter of fact, when I get together sometimes with the people I was with at that time, we share the story. We share about how we moved on from it, but we don't let it define us. And I think that's the big thing, is it didn't define who we were. It was a part in our life that changed our direction, but it didn't make us freeze in time. And I would say the same thing now is, it's going to be with us, all of us, for the rest of our lives. We'll tell stories to our great-grandchildren about what the pandemic was like, but it shouldn't define us and freeze us in that moment forever. And I think that's the thing people should look forward to, is you are going to be different a year from today, but you'll also remember 2 years from today. It's kind of the mindset I'm having.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that, because I know the way I'm trying to take a look at it is, well, I've made it 2 years and I'm here, and I somehow figured out a way to work through all of the changes with school and with work and managing all of those difficulties. So if I can manage that, I can kind of take a breath and keep going.
Yeah, I think I just go back to the really, I mean, with all of my clients that I'm working with, it's really just like a, like, look where you are right now. Like, we're not where we were 2 years ago, but we're not where we were last month either.
Yes.
And looking at the change, and, you know, like you said, resiliency, and resiliency is really kind of a touchy topic sometimes, because there's so many things that go along with resiliency, but there's also like this like beautiful thing that we can look at that's like, okay, well, I've made it this far. Mm-hmm. Like, I have, you know, and one of the really big things that I hear is, well, you know, it could be worse. Like, but we don't have to talk about like, it could be worse. Like, you're allowed to feel how you're feeling. Yeah. Like, let's talk through that. Let's work on how you're feeling in this moment. And that's like the biggest thing, I think, for me.
But not to spoil this positive.
Yeah.
It's the uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
That's like this big, not, yes, like that curved knife, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
That hangs over our heads.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Omicron, which I think really was like the gut punch, because we thought we were done. We had the vaccines. We did what we were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then that happened. And now I'm looking at every day. I look, New Jersey gives me this chart and I see it straight down. Mm-hmm. Makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Really does. But I look back in January, when there's 35,000 cases a day, now there's 800 to 1,000, big difference, but still 800 to 1,000. What's hanging over my head is, who's to say it's not gonna come back? And that's something we have to recognize too. I don't know how to deal with that.
I so relate to what you're saying about Omicron, because for me, as a parent of small children who are over five, thank goodness, so they're vaccine eligible, we had lived, I mean, we definitely lived on the fairly extreme conservative side of COVID. You know, the kids were in cyber school for as long as possible. And then when that wasn't offered by our school district anymore, they were masking with like the KN95s or whatever. And, you know, they were very, we still had our bubble. They were very vigilant. And we kept telling them, as soon as the vaccine comes, we can do everything. Mm-hmm. And then the vaccine came, which was for us the day after Thanksgiving, was I think their first shot or their second shot, I can't remember. And then the day after that, Omicron is announced. And so I feel like I've got this, like, I don't want to hope because I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. And yet that's no way to exist. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking about what I teach my patients of mindfulness, like just this moment, be present in this moment. And that has really been my practice of, you know, if there's anything that's ever going to convince me, don't worry ahead, which is kind of my nature, bring it just to this moment. It's that whole Omicron experience. You know, today is a good day. It's nice out. Cases are down. Let's live today to the fullest. And then we'll adapt if needed for tomorrow.
But it brings me back to what you were talking about in our private conversation about students have shown resiliency, but it's this deep. You know,
it's fragile. You poke up anybody right now, but I'm dealing with students. You poke them too hard in the wrong way and they fall apart. They'll come back together again, but the veneer, they do have it together. They are, as you put it, they are moving forward and they're trying to move forward, but it can break apart if they're not careful. I think as time goes, that thin layer will get thicker and thicker. I mean, I personally take the attitude of, yes, for the last 2 years, it's been the virus. In a couple of years, it might be something else. We have a war right now going on in Europe. I mean, I think there's always going to be something. I mean, partly, I grew up in a very...
When is it not going to be something all the time?
Well, I think that's it. I grew up in a household. My great-grandfather died during the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. I had relatives who lived through World War II, mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor, depressions. I mean, and it was always in our culture and talked about, and it was kind of the attitude of something else is going to come along. And you know what? We're just going to deal with that. And we're going to keep mm-hmm. moving forward and living. We don't need to ignore things, but we don't need to dwell on them either. And I think that's the thing to help younger people to do mm-hmm. is to understand, yeah, stuff's going to happen. We're going to deal with it. It's going to hurt, but we'll keep moving forward. You know, that's the mindset, at least I have, and I try to and mm-hmm. bring to people to help that little veneer get a little thicker and thicker all the time.
I think to add on to that, I really like what Virginia was saying about mindfulness. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to recognize also that healing takes time, mm-hmm. And giving ourselves that space and time to work through all of the emotions we've experienced over these past 2 years, and then giving ourselves a break, like you know what, it's okay if you're feeling this way, and then trying to focus on, okay, well, what is good about today, what can I focus on today? And I really like that comment that Virginia made, because I'm a huge fan of that.
Before we get to questions, I just want to cover one important ground. When 9/11 happened, you brought up 9/11, mm-hmm. we worked together as a nation for a period of time, mm-hmm. When Pearl Harbor happened, mm-hmm. we were together as a nation. We have faced challenges and we've come together. Mm-hmm. What is unique about this that it's divided us mm-hmm. in such a terrible way that we haven't come together? If anything, we've divided even worse.
I love history, so I'll speak about it from that perspective. That throughout history, we've had pandemics. Take even Philadelphia and the smallpox. Mm-hmm. There were actually people who were anti-vax even back then, people who wanted to kill George Washington because he was inoculating his troops. Yeah. So it's in history that we have people who we've not always agreed, but because of social media, it is so prevalent that it's constantly in our faces that we are against each other, as opposed to before, where it was there, but not looming so large. And I think that's it, is people can disagree, but right now it gets hyped up and it gets commercialized, and it people feed off of it. We talked about that before with social media.
And I wonder if, because it seemed like initially in early COVID, we were kind of all together. Think about when all the musicians were offering those free Zoom concerts in their rooms. And there was, at least from my end, there seemed to be kind of a camaraderie, but then the factions formed as, you know, deniers, believers, and all of that. I've definitely felt that in my own community where, you know, my family's been very vocal about like masking in school, et cetera. And it's become kind of a, you know, political thing where, you know, we've definitely made enemies where we used to be friends.
Yeah, we went from banging pots to celebrate the first responders and the nurses to attacking the nurses and the doctors for not giving worm medication. It really has gone sour. Before we go into questions, we'll be very shortly. How do we deal with that? Okay, because we can deal with our own personal problems and talking and creating and doing all the things and reinventing ourselves and those type of things. But how do we heal as a nation? Because that may even be harder.
I mean, one thing that surprises me is, so my kids are having a birthday party next month. And so we wrote to all of our usual pre-COVID friends to say, hey, O'Hares are coming out of hiding. We're having this party. Who's coming? And everyone said, yes, we're coming. And that surprised me because I had thought that these factions of, well, we were on the pro-mask committee and you were on the anti-mask. So sometimes those deep factions aren't actually as deep as we might think. So there might be a sort of human way of connecting, you know, for us through our kids' birthday party, right? So I think some of it might be the story that we're telling us of how, or telling ourselves kind of how deep those fissures run.
Yeah, I think it's getting to a point where we kind of need to accept there's no really right or wrong. And that's where the divide starts, is when I'm looking at you and I'm saying, no, your opinion is wrong, I'm right. Or, you know, vice versa. I think that, I mean, I'm for sure not going to solve the nation's problems.
But well, I thought we were going to do it right now.
But I can change my outlook to looking and saying, okay, you're not wrong. You just have a different belief.
Yes.
And helping people understand that outlook rather than being, nope, you're wrong, I'm right, because what I believe is science, or, you know, vice versa.
We have Karen Alberts going to bring us some of the questions. Hand her the mic.
I got a couple of questions. First of all, someone asked, did Jefferson lift the indoor mask requirement?
Huh. That is the $64,000 question. The university is actively evaluating the policy, and probably an announcement will be coming out within the next day or so as to what the COVID restriction will and will not be.
That's great. Also, in view of what is now known about this mental health impact on COVID, suppose if the virus recurs or if there's another disease threat, what do you think would happen in terms of canceling in-person classes? Do you think that would happen again? Or?
Oh, you know, I want to be optimistic and say no, but I can't say because we don't know what that thing is. There's always a great unknown. I think we've all learned that we would try to avoid that as much as possible. And I want to say that we would work against that. But if it was in the best interest of people's personal health, you know, that might be an option. But I'm thinking that we're all getting a very good handle on how to manage health of people, that would not be as much of an option.
Yeah, that's true. For all of you, I guess, what are some strategies for minimizing conflict with family and friends over differences in risk tolerance, you know, that cause that kind of, you know, risk tolerance of COVID protective behaviors? Any advice on that?
I would say what we've done, because we have friends all over the map. I think respect is everyone has to make their own choices and you can't judge on it. That's their family, it's their choice, and you have to respect it. That's at least, you know, what we've done in my family.
I love that. And I think with the warmer weather too, it's easier to just sort of naturally want to gather outdoors, which, you know, if you're following the data, then that's safer.
Yeah.
Yeah, the timing's good.
Time is good. And what do you suggest, and I guess you've dealt with some of this already, for those who fear social interaction and resuming normal life after changing, you know, their lives so drastically after the couple of years.
I mean, you can always take the approach of like exposure therapy, right? Which is kind of like gradually, like start with an outdoor gathering, then a smaller indoor gathering. I'm personally a fan, and I'm not usually a fan of this within therapy, but in my own N of one right here, of flooding, just like throw myself right into it. And everything that might feel weird, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes, you know, I think to myself, oh, it's going to feel awful having an indoor dinner somewhere. But my body and my mind just kind of remembers this schema of like being in a restaurant, eating food, not worrying so much. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, again, like the thought of the fear makes the fear bigger than the actual fear could be. But, you know, if you're someone who you get into these situations and there is huge fear, I would say start small and kind of work up to it.
Yeah. One last thing. And I think you dealt with this somewhat too. How do you suggest dealing in public with those you see violating, you know, rules, COVID rules, for say masking or social distancing? Do you, you know, approach them, ignore, or whatever?
I think we're really at a point. People have to do what they feel comfortable with and let other people do what they feel comfortable with. And if you don't like what that person's doing, just like, you know, parents would tell you on the playground, just don't be with that person, you know, walk away from them. But I think you have to respect yourself for what you want to do and respect others for what they want to do. And no one needs to be the mask police. No one never really did. People always just need to know what they feel comfortable with doing.
Okay, that's great. And I think we're going to show the resources.
Yeah, if we can go to the last slide, please. We have a number of resources. These, obviously, you can't click on them, but you can go to jefferson.edu and look at these. We'll be supplying this MP4 file on YouTube, so be able to view this later on. I really want to thank this panel. I hope we never get together again on this issue. I want to get together on other issues. And I want to get together maybe a couple of years from now. We'll look back and say, remember that? Remember? We're all going to graduations and proms and parties and resuming as much of a normal life as possible. Thank you so much for this. And I want to thank, again, Lawrence Katz Memorial Fund for paying for this, which is nice. And of course, the All Inspector Center who sponsors this as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.